This is Dr. Ted Hildebrandt in the 8th lecture of his Old Testament History, Literature, and Theology class. This lecture will begin with the sons of God and the daughters of men in Genesis chapter 6 and proceed to Abraham, God's friend, the geography of Mesopotamia, as well as three cuts in Abraham's life, as well as his three alleged children. All right, class, let's get started. Got a lot to cover today. I got to catch up a couple slides from the other class and things. For this week, you guys are working on what? Leviticus, select chapters in Leviticus. There's two articles, one that you're responsible for just to read. The other one you're responsible for content for the dietary laws, I think. And then there's some reading in Our Father Abraham as well. And then a couple of memory verses and things. So I think that's pretty much it. So, there'll be a content question on the Our Father Abraham as well as the article and things. So, okay, I think that's about all we have there. All right, let's open with a word of prayer, and then we'll jump into the Genesis 6 passage and try to get through that again. Father, we thank you for this day. We thank you for the privilege we have in this place of being able to examine your word, to explore ideas that others have thought, and to wonder about your greatness and your goodness and your great mercy that's been expressed to humankind, as well as the great moments of wrath that have come on us. And we pray that you might help us to learn to love you in spirit and in truth. Thank you for your word. Pray that you might help us to reflect it even this day in our lives. In Christ's name, amen. Okay, let's pick up the story. We're working on Genesis. We finally got out of Genesis 1 to 3. So today we're going to move into 6, and we're going to kind of try to move through things rather quickly to get up into Abraham's life. So we were going to talk about the flood and what's going on there with the flood, the sons of God and the daughters of men. So in Genesis chapter 6, let me just read the story there. It says, when men began to increase in number on the earth, daughters were born to them. The sons of God saw the daughters of men were beautiful, and they married any of them they chose. And the Lord said, my spirit will not contend with man forever, for he is mortal, and his days will be 120 years. So what you get is a shrinking down of the days. Remember, they were all living like 900 and something, and now God says their days are going to be shrunk down to 120 years. And the Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and afterward, when the sons of God went into the daughters of men, and children were and had children by them, they were the heroes or the Gibborim, the strong ones of old, and men of renown. Okay, so the question is, the flood comes as a result of these sons of God marrying these daughters of men. Why does God get so upset with that? Who are these sons of God? And so we want to kind of work through some of the question: who were the sons of God, and why did God, you know, get so angry, and actually the flood is a result of this and that type of thing. Yes, Eric.
I think the sons of God were like people who knew God, or they should have known God, and they didn't know God. The daughters of men were just daughters that worship other gods.
Okay, so his suggestion is that the sons of God were the God worshippers of God, and the daughters of men were ones that didn't know. And so this would be basically an interfaith marriage. Well, actually what you have here is that actually fits the first view, what's called the Sethite view. The Sethite view was that the sons of Seth was the godly line. The sons of Cain were the ungodly line. And then there's this intermarriage between the sons of Seth and the sons of Cain. And so you've got this intermarriage. By the way, in other places in Scripture, does God get upset over intermarriage between believers and unbelievers? Do you remember in the New Testament it says, do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers. And so this, Jewish people marrying, do you remember Solomon marrying other wives from other culture and stuff, and that led his heart astray to worship other gods. So the Sethite view plays off of that and says basically the line of Seth, Seth was Abel's replacement. And so Seth becomes the godly line after Abel is killed, and Cain's descendants, and they intermarry, and that intermarriage is the problem. So this is called the Sethite view, so you understand what it is. There's some support to that. It seems to fit naturally in the context and things. My problem is the term sons of God, is that term ever used of Abel's descendants and things? I think not. So there's a second suggestion that's really pretty interesting. And it's this, that the sons of God were the kings and nobles. Were the kings and nobles, that the kings were called. And by the way, in ancient Mesopotamia, did the kings call themselves the sons of the gods? That title was used that the king was considered a son of God. Okay, the king was considered a son of God. So basically what it would be then is that these kings, these people who have acquired power, these sons of God, the kings, basically took women, which would be basically developing their harem. Okay, in other words, they took women into their harem and they're multiplying wives. And the harems have a big problem, both in the ancient world and with the Bible and things. And so this would be the kings establishing a harem, taking women into this harem as kings, multiple wives, that kind of thing. And that becomes a problem. Now, I skipped something. It's very interesting to me that I don't think most people pick up that it was not just these sons of God marrying daughters of men. But there's another word that comes into involved here, and this is over in verse 11, chapter 6, verse 11. It says, "Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight and full of violence." So that apparently there was violence mixed in here too, that was also part of the problem. Now, what is the Hebrew word for violence? This is the Hebrew word for violence. Hamas. Hamas. Okay? Now, some of you may be used to hummus. Okay? Does anybody like hummus? Okay? I don't like American hummus. I like the real hummus is what you get in Jerusalem right across from the fourth station of Christ. The guy has the best hummus in the world. Okay? It's like eating a Philadelphia cheesesteak outside of Philly. Okay? It just doesn't work. You know what I'm saying? In Philadelphia, you get the best. Okay? Over there. But anyways, hummus and hamas are not the same thing. Hamas means violence. By the way, have you ever heard of Hamas? Do you understand? There's a whole group in Israel today named Hamas. And by the way, do you understand what the root of that word means? It means violence, okay? And what are these people bent on doing with Israel? Violence, okay? And so this Hamas group, their name means violence, okay? So everybody says, well, Hamas is really a peaceful organization. They're just trying to, you know, Palestinian rights and stuff. What's their name? Hamas. Does that tell you anything? I mean, it should tell you a lot, but most people don't know that. So anyways, these kings were involved in this, and some people think that these kings then were involved in violence on the people that were below them and things, and so this Hamas was happening. That's a second view. Is the kingship idea going to develop in the Bible pretty big? And did the kings have multiple wives and stuff in a bad way later on with Solomon, you know, 700 wives, 300 concubines, that kind of stuff? So there's some grounds to that. This last view is called the angel view. And I should say, actually, that at various points in my life, I've held each one of these views. Okay, so I don't feel real dogmatic about this. Okay? The view that I hold currently is the angel view, possibly. And largely, it's because in Job chapter 1, verse 6, it talks about the sons of God coming before God. And they were out, and God says, you guys were out, and Satan comes in. He says, oh, you've been out concerning the world. Have you considered my servant Job? And Satan says, oh, yeah, Job's just good to you because, you know, you're good to him. And you take away what he's got, and he'll curse you to your face. And so that was God in the heavenly council addressing them as the sons of God. The sons of God were angels. The sons of God were angels that came before God. Something interesting over in Hebrews chapter 13, 2, it also says, regarding angels and human beings, which is kind of interesting. Hebrews chapter 13, verse 2, sorry for jumping over the New Testament, but it says, keep on loving each other as brothers. Do not forget to entertain strangers, for by so doing, some people have entertained angels without knowing it. People have entertained angels without knowing it. So can angels take on human form? And apparently, sometimes people don't know, and it's possible that they were angels. Now, I'm going to tell a story here. So, Kyle, I'm going to walk over here, and this is going to be one of these weird stories. But once upon a time, I was in a town, Warsaw, Indiana, and I was driving down Route 15, and there was a guy hitchhiking. Now, question, do people hitchhike much today anymore? Not much anymore. Did people in my generation, did everybody, I hitchhiked home from college all the time and stuff. and things. And so this guy was hitchhiking, and I thought, man, I haven't seen a person hitchhiking in a long time. And he looked like he was obviously Hispanic and things, and he needed a ride and stuff. He's probably in his mid-30s and things. So I thought, I drove my car past him once, and I thought, you know, I should pick that dude up. Now, question, do I have a problem there? Because my wife always freaks out when I do this kind of stuff. But I said, you know, hey, it's just me. I've got my kids or my wife in the car. It's just me and him and stuff. So anyways, I was coming back the other way, and I said, you know, I'm going to pick him up. So I picked the guy up. So we rode, and he told me he was basically, he actually got drunk or something. He was in his bed in his house, and the police came and yanked him out of his bed and hauled him down to the jail and actually got tried then for drunkenness. But he said, I wasn't out drinking and driving. He says, I don't have a car, obviously. It's basically, they came in my house and got me and pulled me down here. And so he tells me his tale of woe and stuff. So we drive, and then I thought, you know, it would just take me 5 minutes. I could drive him over to the other Route 13, and then he'd have a clear shot to Syracuse where he's going and stuff. So I drove the guy over there and things like that, and this is no joke. Now you say, this is pretty weird. The guy gets out of the car, you know, so we talked and stuff as just, you know, people and stuff. It was a really, I don't know, I really enjoyed the conversation and stuff, and it was great, and I got to help the guy out and stuff. He gets out of the car. As the guy gets out of the car, this is the honest truth. I still don't know what to make of this. He looks at me and he says, do you know some people have entertained angels unaware and shut the door and walk down the road? I swear this, I didn't make this up. This actually happened. Now, I don't know whether he was just a Spanish guy that had a little bit too much to drink and it was still in him or not, but that, no joke, the guy, I sat there, it was like, where in the world did that come from? You know, the Spanish guy quoting the Bible to me, you know, it's like, man, that's freaky. But anyways, and I'm not saying he was an angel because I couldn't see his halo, but anyways, all I'm saying is you never know. Now, let me go back. Let me take it a different direction with this. Is it possible then, you're down in Boston and there's a homeless person sitting on the side of the street? Is it possible? Hebrews 13, showing hospitality. You never know. And so what I'm saying is that as Christian people, past homeless people, should we feel, you know, compassion, hospitality, and those kind of things toward those people? And should we reach out for them? And my thing is, yeah, you never know, man. That might be an angel sitting there, and you just never know. And so I'm saying is, be careful. There may be, okay. So anyways, Hebrews seems to indicate that there are angels who take on human forms. By the way, you guys already know this. Remember when Abraham and those three guys came up and Sarah made dinner for him and stuff? Were those angels that came up? And apparently, you know, how you've got to figure that out. So Matthew, but you say, wait a minute, but Matthew 22:30 says, angels neither marry nor are given in marriage. Well, what I'm suggesting is that these are fallen angels. These were not angels like in heaven, that don't, but these are fallen angels, and that this is a possibility. Yes, sir?
With the burning bush, I've heard that it's an angel in the bush, but it's also God.
Okay, yeah, that's a different question. He's talking about the Yahweh Melech, the angel of the in the burning bush, okay? It says that he calls him the angel of the Lord. Now, let me just work with that angel concept a little bit. The word angel simply means messenger. So sometimes, to be honest with you, when you're in the book of Revelation, it talks about the angel of the church at Colossae or whatever, or at Laodicea. That simply could mean the messenger that went to that church. Okay? So it doesn't necessarily mean like angel fly wings kind of thing. It may just simply mean a messenger. So the term angel can mean messenger. Okay? Now, one. Now, it's also the angel of the Lord. So it could be the Lord's representative was in the bush. And so my first instinct is, but the problem is with that title, the angel of the Lord is used. And when you're in the bush, when the bush goes to speak, what does he say? Okay. Mission accomplished. I mean, what does the bush say? Okay. What does the bush say? The bush says, he says, what is your name? Okay, let me just do the bush thing. Okay. So Moses comes up to the burning bush and he says, what is your name? And do you remember just before that, the bush said, take off your shoes. Because why? You're standing on holy ground. Question, does an angel come up and say, hey, I'm here, take off your shoes, you're on holy ground? Do you worship an angel? By the way, in Daniel and the book of Revelation, a guy drops down and starts worshiping. This angel's like, you know, awesome. The guy bowing down to this angel. What is the angel? First thing the angel says, get up, don't do it. I'm not. Question, burning bush, take off your shoes. Question, is this the regular run-of-the-mill angel? This is not. And then when he asks him his name, he says, Yehiyeh v'Yehiyeh, I am that I am. An angel doesn't respond like that. That's God's name. So what we want to say is in the burning bush, you have Jehovah, Yahweh, Jehovah, God in the bush, and it's the angel of the Lord. A lot of people would suggest that that's Jesus Christ. It's a pre-incarnate Christ in the bush. He is God, and he speaks, and he is Yahweh. And so he says, my name is Jehovah. My name is Yahweh. I am that I am. So therefore, that angel of the Lord thing seems to be a title that designates also God himself. And when the angel of the Lord speaks, a lot of times it's God. And so you got to work with that. So, but that's a, anyways, sorry for going off on that. But anyways, okay. All right. Where are we here? Okay. Angels don't marry. So what we're saying is that these angels are fallen angels then that have fallen. There's also a passage in Corinthians that talks about the angels looking down on women and stuff. And so it gets pretty weird. But anyways, so I'm just saying it may have been angels. So that there may have been these angels intermarrying with women. And by the way, would that explain then? And they're having children that were giants and strong and stuff like that. Yeah. So that's a possibility. Now, which one of these answers is right? Like I said, I've held at various points in my life, I've held each one of these positions. So I don't know which one's exactly right. I'm with this view, angel view now, but I'm saying, are there certain things you just can't know and you don't know? Now, everybody says, well, what about the Nephilim, you know? The Nephilim. The Nephilim, nobody knows who these Nephilim are. That's back before the flood. So we don't know who these Nephilim are. So then when you don't know something, and by the way, this is an important hermeneutical principle. When you don't know something in Scripture, how do you tell the meaning of a word?
Context,
okay? I'm going to say this like 100 times in this course. What determines meaning? Context determines meaning. But you look at the Nephilim term and you say, okay, now we know Nephilim are a group of people, so we know that from context. But question, do we know what group of people it is? And the answer is no. So when you don't know from context, where do you go next? A lot of times you go to the etymology or the history of the word. So what's the etymology? What's the root, the historical meaning of that? Is to nephal means to fall, okay? To nephal means to fall. So these are the fallen ones. The Nephilim are the fallen ones. And then can you see how that ties into the fallen angel view? What's the problem with depending on etymology for meaning? This is a classic example. So I go home to my wife and I say, honey, you are, I never call her honey, but anyways, honey, you are cute in the original sense of that word. You are cute in the original sense of that word. Well, what's the problem with the word cute? The word cute in the original sense of the word meant bow-legged, okay? And so that's not probably a good thing you want to say to your wife because she's going to think, anyways, oh, well, we don't want to go there. But anyways, so that's not something you want to do. Question, when you use the word cute, did you ever use it in a sense of the original sense of meaning? Do meanings change over time? Do meanings change over time? And can you always go back to the history of a word and tell its original meaning? Is that what it means now? No, it doesn't. So you got to be careful. By the way, if you're in English and you want to find the history of a word, where do you go? Yeah, well, you guys, probably the first place you go is internet. Okay, after your internet, if you go to a real book, like they have books, these things with pages in them and things, there are two of them about this thick, it's called the OED, the Oxford English Dictionary. And in the Oxford English Dictionary, will it go on the word cute for like two pages of cute until it gets back to the root meaning of the word in Anglo-Saxon or Latin or something like that? And it'll give you the root in that kind of a thing. Question, does the history of a word determine its meaning? Does the history of a word determine its meaning? No, it doesn't. So you got to be real careful about this. In the original sense, it meant this. Be careful of those kind of arguments. Meaning and context is what determines, not the history of the word necessarily. So I don't put much stock in that Nephilim fallen ones thing. I put a big question mark by that. I think we're just, you know, it's the only straw we got, so we got to grab it. You know what I'm saying? But, yeah. Okay. Now, this is interesting. In chapter 6, verse 6, it says this concerning God. And the Lord saw how great man's wickedness on the earth had become, and that every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was evil all the time. And the Lord was grieved, and the Lord was grieved that he had made man on the earth, and his heart was filled with pain. My question is, that's Genesis 6:6. The Lord was grieved that he had made man on the earth, and his heart was filled with pain. And the question comes up, is there grief or are there tears in heaven? Okay, Sorry, I just like Eric Clapton, so that's one of my favorites, okay? Are there tears in heaven? Okay? And the answer is, I think Clapton was right. Is God in heaven? Would you say God's pretty much in heaven? Yeah, God's pretty much in heaven, okay? We're not there, He's there, okay? So in heaven, does He feel grief in heaven? The Bible states explicitly that God feels grief. And what I want to suggest to you is there is grief in heaven. That God Himself, it says in Scripture that He feels grief and that He feels pain in heaven. So what I'm suggesting to you is there is pain, there is grief in heaven. Can God be brokenhearted? What I would like to suggest to you, and I'm staying over here for this one, is that who is the being in the universe that suffers the most? What I'm suggesting to you is that God is the most grieving being in the universe because He made things right and it got all messed up and He loves us. And when pain and bad stuff happens and stuff, He grieves over that. And so God is the great grieving being. Now, you say, wait a minute, but doesn't the book of Revelation, at the end of the book of Revelation 22 and stuff, it says 21 and 22, that God's going to wipe away all tears. Well, question, at the end of the Bible, when God wipes away all tears, when it says He wipes away all tears, what does that assume? That there were tears to be wiped away, okay? So what I'm saying is, God wipes away all tears, assumes that there are tears in heaven, and so Clapton is right. Okay, there are tears in heaven. Now, question, is there coming a day when those tears will be wiped away? Is that now? It's not now. As long as there's sin and corruption, does God feel pain? And so someday, the world's going to be made new, and those tears will be wiped away. So, anyways, an interesting way to look at God here and see Him there. And is God sorry over something He did? Does God have regrets? Does God have regrets? Okay. Do parents ever have regrets over their kids? I love my kids, but have there been moments in when I regret? Can my kids make choices and I feel the pain as a parent of their choices? Okay. My kids, I love my kids, and question, can they make choices that hurt really badly? You better believe it. As a matter of fact, the more I love, the worse it gets. If I didn't give a rip about my kids, would I care? But the fact that I love my kids, question, does that make me vulnerable? Do you see that, what I'm saying? The fact that I love my kids, that makes me vulnerable. That I better get out of there. Okay, well, one of my children can make choices that really has been devastating, okay? And, you know what I'm saying? You just, if I didn't care, it wouldn't hurt. If I didn't care, it wouldn't hurt. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, that He had made man. He made man, okay? So He's going back and saying, He's thinking back through the whole thing. Yeah, He's feeling grief over the whole situation that he made. Where were you going with that? I think I may have missed your question. Yeah. Yeah, okay, let me back it out a little bit. Okay, he grieved that He had made man. Question, if they were still in the garden, would He be grieving? No, okay. He's grieved because why? There's this intermarriage, there's this violence, there's this stuff that He describes in the chapter. So that's why He's grieving, is over their wickedness, their evil. And so then he takes a step back from that and says then, and I think, you know, he's thinking about, why did I ever make man? All they're doing is corrupt. They're all totally corrupt. And that's why then he focuses on Noah and things. So, is that?
Well, it just doesn't seem to be what that's saying. I mean, maybe what you think it means is not what it says.
Okay. But what I'm saying is take it and what it says, and you have to put that in the context, right? Is the context in Genesis 6, this intermarriage between these things, the violence that's happening and things. So I'm saying is you can't take that verse out of context and just say, it says God regrets that He ever made mankind, so He just was, you know, bailing out on them totally. No, there was a reason why He felt that way, and you need to explore the reason why, right? Pardon? You're missing a, it's a really important point. You got a verse, you can't yank it out of context. You got to look at it in context. Why did God feel that way? It tells you in the context why He feels that way. And so you've got to relate it to other verses. You just can't pull it out of context like that. Okay, that's why, back to the thing, context determines meaning. So you can't, and this is going to be a really important point for the rest of the class, actually. You can't take things out of Scripture sometimes and then universalize them. You've got to understand them in the context in which they're given. And those contexts will give you then the reasons, the rationale, and those types of things. So you've got to keep things in its context. But, okay. Can God change his mind? Going back to what she was just raising, can God change his mind? He makes man, can he change his mind? Are we going to see God change his mind? Actually, you guys have read Exodus. Did God change his mind in Exodus? Yeah, he's going to, remember when the golden calf, he comes down, I'm going to wipe him out and things, and then Moses prays and stuff, and God changes his mind. Yeah. Yeah, he almost killed Moses and backs off on that in Numbers and things. So, yeah, so we get this thing. Now, what does it mean for God to change his mind? I don't want to develop the whole thing here, but I'm just introducing it here. God, you know, made man, then he has apparently regrets over that. And so what does that mean for God to have regrets? And again, we're going to see this in later texts and things, so just wanting to drop it at this point to say, we're going to get to other texts that are much more explicit where we'll have more context and we can actually sort out what that means. Well, all I want you to do is think about, can God change his mind? What does that mean? Okay, Noah, curse in chapter 9. Noah comes out of the ark with all the animals, 2 by 2, 7 of clean ones, probably 7 clean ones. Why? Because he needs to sacrifice the clean ones afterwards. By the way, did Genesis ever tell us about clean and unclean animals? No, really, when do we learn about clean and unclean animals? It's way over in Leviticus, right? Leviticus, what you guys are going over this week, is telling us clean and unclean. But apparently, did Noah know which was clean and unclean? So is it possible God communed a whole bunch of stuff that's not been recorded for us, but that Noah knew which ones were clean and unclean? So Noah comes out of the ark, and what's the first thing he does? Okay, he basically makes this... get the right passage here. Noah was a man of the soil, and he proceeded to plant a vineyard, and he drank some of its what? Wine. What's the problem when you've got a vineyard? What's the problem in the ancient world when you have no refrigeration? What's the problem? You better drink it quick or is it going to turn? So question, you take it and you turn your grape juice into what? It's going to turn that way anyways, or it turns sour or whatever. You turn it into wine, okay? So he plants a vineyard. Now he's been on a boat for, what, a year or something like that. He comes out, plants this vineyard. He gave it some of its wine and he became drunk and lay uncovered inside of his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw his father's nakedness and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it across their shoulders when they walked backward and covered their father's nakedness. Their faces did not were turned the other way so that he would not see their father's nakedness. Noah woke from his wine and found out what his youngest son had done to him and said, "Cursed be," and then a lowest of slaves will he be to his brothers. And Noah goes off and curses. What did Ham fail to do? Pardon? Cover his dad? Okay. Now, by the way, is it a problem that a child sees... my son and I used to do Taekwondo together, okay? So when we would go in there, do I hide from my son and say, "Son, you have to leave here because I don't want you to see your father's nakedness. So your father will never shower in front of you," and things like that? Because you... Question, is that what this is talking about? No, okay. Yeah, okay. So there seems to be something more than just that. Yeah, Sarah? Okay, yeah. 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 So rather than covering his father like he should have, does he expose his father? Yeah, and he goes off to get his brothers. Now, do his brothers do the right thing and walk backwards to cover their father's nakedness, that kind of thing? So I think you get, and this is a really hard thing in our culture. Is pride and shame a real big in certain cultures? Is pride and shame a big deal in certain cultures? And in certain cultures, you've got this thing about, is it really wrong to shame your parent? Do some cultures feel that very, very strongly? The notion of shame and honor, okay? Shame and honor. By the way, do some cultures feel that so strongly? And now I'm talking about Detroit. Do you remember that with those two girls in the car in Detroit? And the father was shamed by these two girls. And the girls are in the car, and the girl in the back seat's on her cell phone, and her father pulls out a gun and shoots his own daughter in the car. That was in Detroit, in America. And the girl in the back seat, do you remember? She's screaming on the phone, "Dad, Dad, what are you?" And she's screaming on a 911 call and stuff that her father just shot her sister. The father then turns the gun on the back, and you hear the gun go off and the cell phone drop silent and stuff. Did that happen in America, Detroit? Now, by the way, you guys are giving me a lot of blank stares. Do you guys not know about that? Or okay. Now, let me just say this. Did the media put that out there, or did the media cover that up? It was covered up. Why? Because it's politically incorrect to say anything about the background, the obvious background there and stuff. That this guy was so offended as a father that his girls had shamed him and he killed him. By the way, are there honor killings quite frequently in America? And question, will you ever hear about them in the media? And the answer is no. Now you gotta ask yourselves, I wonder why we don't hear about this. Okay, there's some political agenda stuff there. This is called political correctness gone amok. Now, question, in that culture that father was in, is shame and honor a really important idea? Do you guys remember in the tsunami that hit Japan? And do you remember some of the leaders there? They were worried that the leaders were going to commit suicide because they were shamed because they didn't know that the tsunami was going to come in there and destroy that. And so they were worried that some of the leaders in Japan were going to commit suicide because in that culture, if you are shamed by not doing something like that, the people can do some thing, you know, strange stuff like that. So what I'm saying is, in America, do we care about shame and honor in our culture really much? Are we a no shame culture kind of thing? Okay, in other cultures, shame and honor are really, really important. And so what you have here is the shaming of the father, the exposing of the father. To be honest with you, this was several years ago. I read in Ugaritic literature, and in Ugaritic literature, this is just north of Israel, just a little bit north of Israel. In some of these Ugaritic tablets, it says that one of the duties, and it lists it out explicitly, that one of the duties of sons is to cover their father's nakedness. That is the duty of a son. Okay? The duty of the son is to cover their father's nakedness. And so it'd be like, your father gets drunk. Question, should the son drive the father home? And take care of the father, that kind of a thing, rather than exposing him and stuff. And so I think that's what you've got here, this shaming thing, this honoring thing. Yeah.
I have a question on that verse. I didn't understand why Noah cursed Canaan instead of Ham.
Okay. Okay.
Why didn't he curse Ham's other son?
Okay. She blew my punchline, man. Okay, she's a step ahead of me here. But I was. Let me see if I can get away with it and still do it, okay? All right, how about this, okay? So Noah then wakes up, finds out what his sons did, finds out what his other son has done, and so he says then, cursed, and then he curses his son, and he says, the lowest of slaves will he be to his brothers. Now, Ham's descendants go where? If you follow the tree, do we have the genealogies, these kids? Ham's descendants become Cush. Cush goes down into Ethiopia, and so basically Ham's descendants go down into Africa. And then Noah curses them and says, the lowest of slaves will he be to his brothers. So some people have argued that this is the curse on basically Africa, that this is a curse that the lowest of slaves will he be to his brothers, that Ham's curse is that his descendants will be slaves, and this is a curse on Africa, and therefore having African slaves is a, you know, the Bible tells us that this is the curse of Noah, and therefore, you know, legitimizes that in some sense, okay? Now question, have people used that argument? That argument has been used. Now, what she did was blow my punchline. And then I misread the text, but anyway, she caught me. Yeah. Yes.
Anna? I thought that was referring to the Israelites moving to
Canaan. Okay, yeah. Okay, both of them are. Let me read the text, what it actually says. Noah gets up and he says, cursed be Ham. He doesn't say that. He doesn't say cursed be Ham. He says, cursed be Canaan. Canaan's descendants, this is real hard, Canaan's descendants settle where? The land of Canaan. Where's the land of Canaan? That's the promised land. That's Israel, okay? Canaan's descendants become who? It's really tough again. When you don't know what they are, just put an ite or tite on the end, okay? Jebusite, Hittite, Gergesite, okay? So it's what? So here, it's Canaanite. So it's Canaanite. The Canaanites settled in the promised land, and so it's the land of Israel. So is this a... Woo. Oh, you know, actually, okay, my computer's going bananas on me. You have to plug them in. Okay. All right, let's see. All right, okay. That'll do it. Sorry. So do you see the point here? So Canaan is being cursed here. It's not the descendants of Ham down into Africa. This has nothing to do with the Cushites and the Africans and the slavery there. It has everything to do with the Canaanites. Now, by the way, would the Canaanites and the Israelites butt heads? There's going to be battles later on between the Canaanites and the Israelites. And so this foreshadows that, the battle with the Canaanites, not the battle with, you know, down into Africa and things like that. Okay, now, her other question, both of your questions, let me try to develop that a little bit, okay? Have you still got this thing? Ham is the son of Noah and exposes Noah's nakedness and things and kind of defiles, shames his father. And I think what you have here is what's called lex talionis, the law of retaliation. And what we'll see this later and we'll develop it more. This is the eye for eye, tooth for tooth. As you have done to me, so it will be done to you. Eye for an eye, tooth. As you have done to me, so it will be done to you. So I think what Noah does here is he says, as you, Ham, have shamed me and you are my son has shamed me, so Ham, your son will shame you. And so what I think he's doing is saying Canaan here. Now, by the way, is this conjecture? Okay, yes, this is conjecture on my part, okay, and stuff. But you know what I'm saying? I'm trying to put that together, why the Canaan is cursed. But it seems to be this reciprocal, in other words, as you have done to me, so your son will do to you.
It just didn't make sense when I was reading it. Yeah. And also, I mean, if he had just cursed Ham,
yeah.
The Bible also mentions how a curse will go from many generations.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Canaan is picked out, I think, because I think that's a foreshadowing of what Israel will do. And so you get that kind of stuff already set up kind of in the scriptures and stuff. So anyways, this gets pretty complicated stuff. So where did Ham's descendants settle? We said some of them went down to Africa, but some of them were the Canaanites. Was the curse that enslaved the Africans? And the answer is no, this has nothing to do with that. Canaan is the one who was cursed here, not Cush and other Ham's descendants. Okay, so who was actually cursed? Who was actually cursed was Canaan. Okay, now this is the broader question, and this one gets difficult as well. We're dealing with a lot of cultural issues here, and some of these cultural issues are really hard, especially when we live in America. Question, do we know much about shame and honor in our culture? And the answer is no, but in other cultures, it's life and death, as we've experienced in America, even lately, with some of the stuff that's gone on, but then hushed up. Is it right that the children suffer for the sins of the parents? I also want to think about in terms of how does punishment happen? Does punishment, we are Americans, do we see ourselves as individuals? We see ourselves as individuals. Do you realize that in other cultures, they don't see themselves so much as individuals, but they see themselves as part of a group? That their identity is wrapped up in their family group. And that, by the way, will the Bible even then have certain family groups be judged as whole families? And so you get this idea that there's judgment falls on a whole group of people. Now, by the way, even as Americans, does this happen? Does this group thing happen even in America? Okay. For example, my son, it was about a week ago, we were discussing something like this, and he came up with this. He said, okay, suppose you guys were born in Afghanistan. Suppose you were born in Afghanistan. Now, question, you're not Taliban. You're out farming your little thing. You've got 2 acres of ground. You've got a few sheep and a few goats, mostly goats, and you're poverty stricken. You've got a wife. You've got a couple kids and stuff. And all of a sudden, you didn't do anything. You didn't do anything. And all of a sudden, there's this 6'2", 200-and-some-pound Marine guy busting in the door of your house. And he goes through every stinking thing in your house. Now, question, did you do anything to deserve that? Did you do anything to deserve it? You didn't do anything to deserve that. What did you do? The only thing that you did to deserve that was that you were an Afghani, that you were an Afghan person. Okay? Question, Taliban does bad stuff. Question, does that affect other people? Does that affect other people? Let me put it in American context, okay? Don't do this, okay? You're out driving in a car, and it's 1 o'clock in the morning, and one of your friends has had too much to drink, and he's driving, okay? You're in the car. There's 4 kids in the car. There's 4 kids in the car, and he's been drinking too much. Okay, question. When he gets in a wreck, better get off this. But anyways, when he gets in a, and let me just say, let me just be the sarcastic me, okay? When he gets in a wreck, who walks away? He does. Is it possible other people in the car get killed and he walks away? Does that bother me? You better believe it bothers me, because I actually, in one case, I know the kid's name and stuff, and he's a friend of mine. What I'm trying to say to you, is it possible to be in a car? Why is this person killed? Is it just the fact that he's in a car with somebody else who crashes the car? And it wasn't any of their fault at all. But, you know what I'm saying? They're the ones killed. And he walks away. Do you see what I'm saying? So is it possible for somebody to make a decision and it affects other people in the group? Yeah. And that's, how should I say, that's just the way it is. That's just the way it is. And so I'm saying is the group thing affects things. And so you get this, actually the apple from the tree too. Are there things that go down in families from parents to child, from parents to child? My, oh boy, this is on tape. I mean, there's a family I know about that where the there's been a marriage in the family, and the guy who married into the family is always saying of the daughter, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, as he looks at the mother of the family. Now, question, is there a connection between mother and daughter? And is this guy who married into this crazy family, is he seeing the connection between the mother and the daughter? Yes, and he says that. And anyways, that's a family I'm very vaguely aware of. But you know what I'm saying, a family of three. So we better get out of there. Okay, let's get over to Abraham. Okay, we're going to jump into the Abraham narratives now. We're out of the Garden of Eden. We're out of Noah and the Flood. And let's jump over and look at Abraham. Chapter 12 in Genesis. We're finally making it. We're going to start moving faster, too. You know, I can't answer all the questions in Scripture that you guys have and stuff. I try to hit on the ones that I think are big questions and hit on those. But Abraham. Abraham is going to be... Abraham is one of the most incredible individuals in the Old Testament. We've even, Dr. Wilson, some people say that he's met him and stuff. He says he's Abraham's a good guy and things. And so, anyways, I shouldn't say it, but Dr. Wilson's book, Our Father Abraham and things, Dr. Wilson is up there with Abraham, in my opinion, actually. I can't tell you. No, I'm serious. I can't tell you how much I respect Dr. Wilson. And he's done a study on Abraham, and I think for good reason. Abraham is, and Abraham's title, I'm going to give each one of these guys a title from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And the title for Abraham is that Abraham is God's friend. Now, did I just make that up? And the answer is no. Here's James chapter 2, verse 23. And the scripture was fulfilled that says, see if you remember this, Abraham believed God, and it was counted, and it was credited to him for righteousness. Does that sound familiar? And then Abraham was called God's what? Friend. Is that a pretty big title for somebody to be called God's friend? What does it mean to be God's friend? I'm going to try to show you through this what it means to be God's friend. And that, by the way, am I saying Abraham's perfect? No, Abraham's going to have his problems, all like all human beings have their problems. But Abraham's called God's friend. And I just want to, I'll come back at this. The last slide will come back to this on Abraham being God's friend. Now, before we do that, we got to do a little bit of geography. Do you guys download the PowerPoints? Download the PowerPoints. Will these maps be in the PowerPoints? So you won't have to try to draw these maps. I can never draw these maps very well. But anyways, I just want to run through this map. This becomes important for all the rest of the Bible. This is the playing field. This is the chessboard. We're going to start over here on the Persian Gulf, okay? Got the Persian Gulf here, all right? And then we got... Kind of looking at this, okay, the Persian Gulf. Now, we want to come up here, the Euphrates River and the Tigris River, okay? The Tigris and the Euphrates River. And so we've got, how do you tell which one's which? Does anybody know E.T.? Does anybody know E.T.? Okay, E.T., E.T. is Euphrates, Tigris. You can always tell which order they come in, E.T., Euphrates and Tigris, okay? And then, Kyle, you getting this on the film there? Okay, we got it. Good. Okay. Ur of the Chaldees. We've got the Persian Gulf down here. What country is this? Iran. What country is this? Iraq. Okay, so we're familiar with these two countries. Okay, these are mountain folk. These are the plains folk. Do mountain folk and plains folk always fight? Yes. Okay, so these people are always going to be trying to push down. These people are always going to try to be what? Pushing back. Okay, and by the way, is that true today? Has that been true for 2,000 years, 3,000, 4,000 years? Yeah. Here's the Persian Gulf. We come in here, here's Kuwait. And basically, you got the Tigris and Euphrates River. Does everybody see Ur here? That's Ur. Now, Abraham was from Ur of the Chaldees. If I say to you Warsaw, what comes to your mind immediately? Warsaw, Poland. Okay, you guys say Warsaw, Poland. If I said to you Warsaw, Indiana, in other words, if I just say Warsaw, you guys think Poland, but I'm thinking about Warsaw, Indiana, where I used to live. So because Warsaw, Indiana is lower level than Poland, you know, Warsaw, question, do I have to qualify that by saying Warsaw, Indiana? I think what you have is when it says Abraham is from Ur of the Chaldees, is exactly that. This is the big Ur from Sumer. This is the big Ur from Sumer. And in most of your Bibles, it will put that Abraham is from here, and he goes all the way up. He's going to go up to Haran here. What I would suggest to you, and I'm feeling more strong about this, but I still don't know for sure because we don't know. But what's been suggested now is that there is a northern Ur from up here, and that Abraham came down to Haran as he makes his way down into Israel. By the way, does that make a lot more sense than going from here, and instead of going over to Palestine this way, going way up to Haran? So what the suggestion is that there's a northern Ur up here that's Ur of the Chaldees. It's Ur of the Chaldees, and so he's specifying it's up from where the Chaldeans came from, and that he then comes from this Ur. We don't know where that place is, okay? There's like literally hundreds and hundreds of tells up there. We don't know what the place is. So, and they're up here, and he comes down here. So there's a northern Ur. What I'm just trying to say is there's a northern Ur and there's a southern Ur. And I'm kind of going with the north now myself, but I mean, I taught this for decades, but I think I've seen some good argumentation now that there's a northern Ur, okay? Now, what other places? So this is one place that's really important. There's another place called Mari here. This place called Mari is right where the Euphrates comes up. And from here, if you've got a good double hump camel with a four on the floor, you can make it all the way across. Okay? So this is the first place when you come here, you can grab water. Now, but what's the problem? Why can't you just go across like this? Why didn't Abraham just go across like this? Go across the desert. Have you ever... Have you ever been a place where you caught into a desert and you're on foot? There's no cars. You can't just jump in the car. And every direction, as far as your eye can see, is absolute desert. Question, does that scare the daylights out of you? And the answer is, I was 25 when that happened. And it was as far as your eye could see and there was no way out. You got your feet, no cars, no nothing. Question, is that spooky? I just want to tell you. So you come out in the desert there. Does anybody go out there? Well, today, yeah, you say people drive cars out there. Okay, but when you've got just a camel, even the camels don't make it across here very well. But they can make it from here. So Mari is going to be an important place. They found a bunch of tablets at Mari. So we're going to have tablets from Mari. The other place that there's tablets is from Nuzu, this place called Nuzu. They found several thousand tablets from Nuzu. Nuzu is where a lot of the customs come from. We're going to see a lot of ancient customs that I'm going to tell you, well, this was a custom of that day. How do we know that? They found these tablets at Nuzu, and so Nuzu will tell us a lot of the customs coming from back around, you know, 1700, 1800 BC, within a couple 300 years of Abraham. So these two places, Mari and Nuzu, are going to give us a lot of information about the time just after Abraham that's going to be really help us to interpret the Bible. Yes?
Does Mari have anything to do with the bitter water
tomorrow? No. Okay, she's referencing down here at a place, Sinai, possibly here, that was called Mara, that meant bitter, that the water was bitter. That's down here in Sinai. This is the Sinai Peninsula. This is, Mari's totally different. Yeah. So as you come up here, so Mari and Nuzu, here's Haran. Who's famous from Haran that you know? Rachel, Leah was from there, and who got them hooked up was Laban. Does remember Laban? And do you remember Rebekah, that Isaac married Rebekah? She was also from Haran, and she, remember, she did the watering of the camels thing up here in Haran. So Abraham's home, is this really Abraham's home? After he leaves Ur, he sets up camp in Haran. That's where Terah, his father, dies. That's where Laban is. That's where Rachel and Leah are from. That's where Rebekah is from. So Haran's kind of their home. They then set up. Abraham then leaves and comes down this way. Now, two sites over here. One is called Eblah. The Eblah site comes from about 2400 B.C. It was discovered, I believe, in the 1980s or 70s. Now, by the way, why is 2400 B.C., why is that important for us? Abraham was what?
2000.
Is Eblah 400 years before Abraham?
No.
So that's back before Abraham, 400 years. So that's going to put Abraham in a framework. You know what I'm saying? It's going to give us 400 years before Abraham what it was like. This place called Ugarit is another place. By the way, this place, the Ebla, there's real problems there. Now, Ebla is in what country?
Syria.
Does Syria like having people find Bible-fulfilled stories at Ebla? And so what's happened is they first came out and said, you know, Sodom and Gomorrah was founded, the Ebla tablets, and then the Syrians got a hold of stuff with some of the Italians and stuff. And now, basically, to be honest with you, we don't know that much about Ebla. It seems like the site has been, you know what I'm saying, a lot of stuff isn't coming out. There's a ton of stuff there, and it's a shame. The world hasn't really been able to get at it because it's been... Oh, by the way, is there really some tough stuff going on in Syria right now? Do you realize the Syrian Assad is killing his own people now? Okay? His father killed like 10,000 in one village and stuff. So Syria is doing some really bad stuff right now, killing his own people, Assad, and stuff. So, that you know, anyways, so this is the kind of the background now in archaeology. By the way, what's the capital of Assyria? What's the capital of Syria? Damascus? Okay, Damascus is the capital. Damascus is one of the oldest cities in the world. And so it's really kind of quite a city. And this is Damascus in Syria. Now, up here, Ebla, 2400 BC, a bunch of tablets. We don't know what's in them because the Italians got a hold of it and the Syrians are spies and stuff. Ugarit. Ugarit dates from about 1400 to 1200 BC. And Ugarit, they found thousands of tablets there. There's actually a language called Ugaritic, which I've had the unfortunate privilege to be able to learn to read in transcription. And Ugarit, guess what they found there? In the Bible, have you ever heard about Baal? Baal in the Bible? In the Bible, we're told that there's this god Baal. We don't know much about him. Do you realize that there are whole myths now? We've got tablet after tablet telling us myths about Baal and Asherah, his consort. So we know tons of stories. We know who Baal is now, largely out of Ugarit and stuff. So Ugarit's going to give us things around the time of the Judges, okay? And then we come down into Israel. We've got the Sea of Galilee, Jordan River, Dead Sea. Now you come down here. This is Sinai. You can see the Sinai Peninsula here where they crossed over into Sinai. And this is what here, this is what country? Egypt. That city is Alexandria, is named after Alexander the Great. Okay, Alexander from Alexandria. What was Alexandria famous for?
Library.
They tried to get, it was like the early Library of Congress. This library, they tried to get every book in the world that was, scroll and things like that. It was an incredible thing. Is burned, torched, and stuff, and so we don't have any other records, but we have records that this place was a center of learning. This Alexandria, Alexandria was the Boston of the ancient world. In other words, you know what I'm saying? It was a center of education, learning, and that kind of stuff, huge libraries and stuff. Now you come down, you come down Cairo, Memphis. When I say Memphis, what's the first thing that comes to your mind? Memphis, Tennessee? Does anybody do Memphis, Tennessee? And the reason why I always bring that up is because of the king. The king is buried in Memphis. And I said the king in the last class period, and they didn't know who I was talking about. But for my generation, there's only one king, and that was Elvis, okay? Memphis, Tennessee. You ever go there, wear your blue sage shoes, hit Memphis. Anyway, sorry. Okay, there's another place down here called Tel Amarna. And this is where they have the Amarna letters. This is not important for us right now, but will be later on. So Egypt is here. Egypt is the gift of the Nile. If you take the Nile out, what is left of Egypt? Desert for like thousands of miles in each direction. Egypt is the gift of the Nile. Everything. If you actually get on a Google satellite, can you actually go down and see the Nile River? And it's really kind of cool. And a Google satellite image. Now, let me show you another map that kind of schematizes this whole thing. And I forgot one city as I did. Here's southern Ur. Here's Babylon, Mari, Nuzu, Nineveh. As soon as I say Nineveh, what comes to mind? Jonah. When I was younger, I thought Jonah rides this whale. The whale spits him up, and then he goes to Nineveh. And I thought, you know, what's the problem with this picture? The whale's out here. Did the whale swim all the way around Africa, swims up the Tigris River? What's the problem? Tigris River is like 3 or 4 feet deep, and so it was a real skinny whale. But anyways, so then the whale spits him out up here. Question, did the whale spit Jonah out up here? No chance, okay? You'd have to swim all the way around Africa. The Suez Canal wasn't built. So what happened is when the whale spits him out here, does Jonah have to walk all the way over there? That's a long haul, by the way. And so Jonah, it just puts Jonah in a different context because I had him, you know, like getting out of the whale and going preaching and stuff. He had a long way to think about it before he got over to Nineveh. So Nineveh is the capital of Assyria. Really nasty people there. They were the Hitler's I'm just making generalizations now, but they were the Hitlers of the ancient world. They were incredibly cruel people, Nineveh. Jonah preaches repent. What do the people do? They repent. It was a kind of incredible, shocked the daylights out of Jonah. Now, Mari has 25,000 tablets. There were 25,000 tablets found at Mari. There was 5,000 found at Nuzu. Nuzu is a place where we get a lot of our customs from. Ebla, there was about 18,000 tablets. Many of those are still, we're waiting, to be honest, we're still waiting for some of these to be translated. Ugarit, I think, in my mind, I remember, I think it was about 12,000 tablets found there. There's a whole new language called Ugaritic. This, by the way, is Eblite. This is a whole new language for us, too. Damascus. So these are the places that I want you to know. Is that okay? So just work off this. These places, just kind of learn it. E.T., right? Euphrates, Tigris. Okay. And then, by the way, just for the nuts of it, what's this? Sea of Galilee, Jordan River, Dead Sea. Okay. It's an artist's conception. Or misconception, probably. Okay. Now, I actually found some of these tablets. And I just wanted you to see. Remember how I told you that they stick in the mud when they write with a stylus? This is actually a Mari tablet from about 1750 BC. There's this guy named Zimri Lin. He was king of Mari. And guess who Zimri Lin butted heads with? You know this guy. Hammurabi. Okay, Hammurabi and Zimri Lin duked it out. We've got actually tablets now from Zimri Lin saying Hammurabi's beating up on me and stuff like that. So these are the tablets. By the way, do you see the way the tablets are stuck with a stylus? You can actually see the end of the stylus and the front of the stylus. It's like a bulrush kind of thing, and you stick it in the mud. And can you see that they stick it this way, then they stick it this way, and they stick it different ways? This is a syllabic language. A syllabic language means that each syllable gets a symbol. How many different symbols or syllables are there? If I gave you the two consonants R and D, R and D, how many syllables can you make out of R and D? You can make rad, you can make rude, you can make rid, you can make, you see what I'm saying? So just out of R and D, can you make maybe 15 or 20 different syllables? Now, if each one of those syllables had a different symbol and you had 800 syllables and you had to learn 800 symbols before you could read or write, who could read or write in this culture? Only the very wealthy. Did you have to be a scribe? Did you have to be a scribe, a paid scribe, to learn to read? So that meant the elite could read. Could the common person read this stuff? Probably not. Now, okay, let me just leave that. So basically what these things are written by scribes, professional scribes, high-class people. Very few people can read. This is from one of the Mari tablets. You can see how it is. By the way, these mud tablets, what happens when they burn the temple down? It fires it. It gets harder, and so that's why they preserve. Now, here's one, and this is really cool. This is from Ebla. By the way, can you see the columns and how they write in columns? You see that? And this is, and by the way, this doesn't show it, but on the side, sometimes they'll stick in the side. They'll write down this. The tablets are about as wide as your iPad, okay? And they'll stick them in the side, and they'll write down the side of these things as well. It's pretty weird stuff, isn't it? But this is what a tablet, look, this is an amazing tablet. Are a lot of these tablets busted? Are a lot of these tablets busted? This is a full tablet. This is kind of an amazing one. And so, by the way, this is an Ebla tablet. Is it possible that a doctoral student at University of Pennsylvania would spend 5 to 7 years working on a doctorate reading this one tablet, and then when he gets it done, he will get a PhD? Yeah, this is what happens, okay? University of Pennsylvania in the basement, they've got all these tablets that nobody's ever read before. And these people will, they kind of like are dungeon dwellers. They'll put them down there. The guy stays down there for 5 years. He comes out, he reads the tablet, and he gets a doctorate. Okay, that was a joke. Thanks. Okay, that was a joke. All right. But there's some truth to that. But anyway, so this is the tablet, what they look like. Now, here's one, and this one is really neat because what is this? This is a Ugaritic tablet. You see how it's very small and different. What's different about this one is this one's from about 1400 to 1200. This is from the time of the judges, about Joshua, judges, that kind of stuff. This one's alphabetic. What is the advantage of the alphabet? Syllabic languages, you have to learn 800 symbols before you can read and write. With the alphabet, it goes by phonemes, it goes by how they're said, and there's only about 22 to 30 different sounds. And therefore, the alphabet is only 22 or 30 symbols. Now, question, how smart do you have to learn to be to learn 22 symbols? Can a kindergartner learn 22 symbols? Can a kindergartner learn 22 symbols in kindergarten? So therefore, with the alphabet, is this kind of an amazing thing? Can the common person read after about 1800 BC? Is the alphabet an incredible invention? I guess that's what I'm trying to say. Is the alphabet an incredible invention that allowed the common person to be able to read? So that in the book of Judges, they catch a kid running out of this town. The guy catches this kid, grabs him, and says, "Hey, write down all the names of the elders in the town." And the kid writes it out. Just a kid, common kid, caught randomly. He writes it down. When he got an alphabet, people come. Now, let me just push this one more thing. Two more things. So does the alphabet democratize learning? Does the structure of the alphabet, 1800, does it democratize learning? Yes, it does. Push it one more. About 1450s, in the 1450s, you got a guy who developed a thing called the printing press. Now, instead of one person copying one manuscript with a printing press, have you got one person able to produce 1,000 manuscripts? Question, does that again democratize learning, the printing press? Do you see what the incredible invention of the printing press in the 1450s did? Gutenberg and things changed the whole map. And now, what's happened? Now, how big is your alphabet? 2. We've gone from 22 down to 2. And your alphabet is 0 and 1. And with 0 and 1, question, can I write your alphabet in ASCII code? Yes, with a 0 and 1. With a 0 and 1, can I put this in a JPEG image and turn that 0 and 1 into a picture? Yes. Can I take that same 0 and 1 alphabet and can I turn it into sound and put it in an MP3 that you can play and you can hear? Can I take that same 1 and 0 and put it into a video and play those things at 30 frames a second? The 1 and 0. In your generation, do you see what's happening? This is you guys. This is your generation. Is this tremendous what has happened in the last 20 years? And question, can I take that 1 and 0 and can I put it on my computer and communicate to a guy who's studying Greek, who's studying Greek and watching my avatar in India? And then just before school starts, the guy in South Africa using it. What, the 1 and 0, can that go all over the world? Question, what happens? Is learning getting democratized? And my question to you is then, as we as Christians, do we use that 1 and 0 now, the power of the 1 and 0, for the glory of God and the good of others? Or do we let evil use it? Will evil use it? Yes. And so what I'm suggesting is you guys live in a day and age that, to be honest with you, I'm jealous in a certain sense. I'm an old man. I'm kicking off and probably just, shortly here probably. That's the honest truth. And I'm getting to be an old man and stuff. But you guys got, there's so much stuff just right in your face. And all I'm saying is grab it, man. Go for it. It's tremendously powerful. And it's you guys have seen it. It's happening in your generation. It's really cool. So anyways, alphabet. Alphabet's really important. Now, three cuts. We're going to talk about Abraham. And Abraham's got his three cuts, chapters 12 and following with Abraham, 12 to 25. The first cut that Abraham has to make is with his own family. The Lord had said to Abraham, leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to a land that I will show you, and I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. And I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. And I will bless those that bless you and curse those who curse you. Okay? Abraham, first cut, he's got to leave his family. By the way, is it hard to leave one's family? Now, you guys are from America. We move all over the place. You say, no, it wasn't hard at all. I come to Gordon College. It's good. Okay? When you were raised in those cultures, when you were reared in the same family, all your brothers and sisters, your cousins, your nephews, your father and mother not only live there, but your grandfather, your grandmother, and all their siblings live in the same town. Question, when you left that kind of a village, was it a big deal to leave? It was a big deal to leave. And God says, the first thing he says to Abraham, leave. Who's going to be your family now? Basically, God is going to lead him to a land and show him a new land and stuff. So the cutting of family ties is a big deal. Why is it that when God calls people so often, there's this leaving behind of something? When he calls people, there's often this leaving of something. Moses has to leave the Sinai desert and go back into Egypt and things. So this is a common thread that happens quite frequently in Scripture, this cutting of family ties. Now, In chapter 14, Abraham is out chasing down. Do you remember Lot? Do you remember Lot was Abraham's like nephew or whatever? And Lot and Abraham split. And then there's this king, Chedorlaomer, comes down and basically runs off, kidnaps Lot, and he hauls Lot and his family off. And Abraham gets his 318 guys. They go out there. They capture this king. They recapture Lot, and he's coming back. He actually is victorious. Abraham is victorious. He comes back, and as he's coming back, Abraham runs into this guy just out of the clear blue. He runs into this guy called Melchizedek. Okay, you guys call him Melchizedek. Melchi means king. Zedek means righteousness, king of righteousness. So he runs into Melchizedek, the king of righteousness, Melchizedek. By the way, Melchizedek is king of what city? By the way, this is important too. Yeah, he's the king of Salem. He's king of Salem. But in Hebrew, you say city of, you say Jeru, Salem. And if you say Jeru, city of Salem, and you say Jeru, Salem, very fast, you've got what? Jerusalem. This guy is king of Jerusalem before kind of like Jerusalem was the city of David and all this stuff was nothing. Melchizedek is king of David, king of the city of Jerusalem. Melchizedek shows up. What does Abraham do to this guy? Abraham gives him a tenth of everything he has. This guy is not only king, but he's also a priest. So he's a priest and he's a king and he's a priest of the Most High. And Abraham pays him a tenth of everything he has. Does Abraham honor this guy? Yes. Now, somebody in the last class asked me, they said, well, in the book of Hebrews, is Melchizedek Jesus? Is Melchizedek pre-incarnate Christ? Some people think that Melchizedek was a pre-incarnate Christ. I kind of back off from that myself. I kind of think that this guy is a king and a priest, and so he typifies Christ. He's like Christ in the Old Testament, but he's not really Jesus. He appears out of nowhere, and then actually after chapter 14, we never hear about the guy again. He's gone. So he just kind of appears. Abraham pays him a tenth, and then boom, he's gone again. So some people think it's Christ. I think it's probably just typifies Christ, that there's a person who is a priest and a king like Jesus would be. And so that's why he does, you know, similar things with Jesus. But there's different approaches that Hebrews picks that up as a thing. So that's Genesis Melchizedek. Kind of an interesting thing. The honest truth is, we don't really know. He's kind of he just appears and disappears in the text. The point of why I raise this is, though, that this. In the Old Testament, is it only the Jews that know God? In the Old Testament, is it only the Jews that know God? Question, did Melchizedek, was he Jewish? No. Abraham, didn't have any kids yet, okay? So he can't be Jewish, okay? The guy's not Jewish, okay? And does he know God? Does he know the Most High God? Yes. Does Abraham honor him for knowing the Most High God? Yes. So what I'm suggesting is that in the Old Testament, don't think that it's just the Jews. God's just dealing with the Jews. There are other people that are going to pop up in the text that you're going to read, that these guys out of nowhere come and they know Jehovah God. So that's interesting to me. Here's a guy who's non-Jewish who knows God. He's a priest of the Most High God. He's a king in Jerusalem. Now, another cut here is in chapter 15, and this is a tough one. In chapter 15, down about verse 10 or so, as the sun was setting, verse 12, Abraham fell into a deep sleep. A thick and dreadful darkness came over him. Then the Lord said, "Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and they will be enslaved and mistreated for 400 years." What would that be? They will be enslaved and mistreated for 400 years. Yeah. Does God tell Abraham beforehand that his descendants are going to go into Egypt for 400 years and be mistreated and enslaved? God tells him that ahead of time. And then he says, and God comes and tells him some other things. And then he says, basically, I can't give you the land yet because the sin of the Amorites is not yet full. So Abraham, I'm going to give you this land, but I can't give it to you yet because the sin of the Amorites is not yet full. What is the implication? Is God saying that the sin of the Amorites is getting fuller and fuller, and when it reaches a certain level, then he's going to bring in the Jews to destroy them, but it's not yet full, so that he can't have the land. And verse 17 of chapter 15, when the sun had set, darkness had fallen, a smoking fire pot with a blazing torch appeared and passed between the pieces. Abraham had to cut this animal in two. Abraham cuts this animal in two, and then this blazing fire pot goes between the two parts of the animal. Now, is it obviously something symbolic is going on here? Something symbolic is going on. And it turns out that we've got a good guess at what this C means. There's two things that it could be. One is, as this animal used to be one, it's now cut in two. As this animal used to be one, now God and Abraham are made one in the covenant. By the way, do we have covenants even till this day where two are made one in a covenant? Just think about that. We have covenants today where two are made one in a covenant today. Yeah, marriage, okay? And so what you have is this covenant where God and Abraham are being bonded together in union, symbolized in this, as this animal was one, now we are becoming one, and that's possible. Has anybody ever done this? You guys probably don't do this in your generation, but in my generation, we had this thing called Blood Brothers. And so Dave Remes and I, basically when we were younger, we cut ourselves. Don't do the. Well, actually, you guys do this slashing stuff, so anyways. But anyway, so... Sorry. That was a joke. Chill out, okay? That was a joke. All right. But the honest truth is, so Remes and I wanted to be blood brothers, okay? We were really good friends. He was like my best friend. We wanted to be blood brothers. And so he cut himself, I cut himself, and we swapped blood. Don't do that today. But anyways, we didn't know any better back then, so we swapped blood. So is Dave Remes, is he like my blood brother for life? You know what I'm saying? So this idea of blood bonding things together is what I guess I'm trying to say, okay? So now, there's another approach to this, and I think the second one is probably more accurate. And what this is it jumps off of Jeremiah chapter 34, verse 18. And the symbol that's used in Jeremiah is that this animal is cut in two. That is, if you violate the covenant, you will be cut in two like this animal. If you violate the covenant, you will be cut in two like this animal. And so this is called the ratifying of the covenant. How do we ratify covenants today? Have you guys ever been to the bank and you get a notary, and a notary like does that thing on the paper and makes it and stuff? That's like ratifying the covenant, okay? It's like approving it, you know, when they stamp on it and it's good. So this is ratification or solemnizing of the covenant. As this animal was one, was cut in two. If you violate the covenant, you'll be cut in two. Now what happens with that? Who passes between the two parts? God does. And so what God is doing here is binding himself to Abraham. The smoking fire pot represents God, possibly. And then what it's saying here is that God is binding himself to Abraham in this covenant, that God will keep his covenant. Now, by the way, what is the covenant of God? God promised Abraham three things. They are the land, the promised land, the land of Canaan, the seed, that his seed would be multiplied as the what? Stars of the heaven, that his seed would be multiplied as the sand of the seashore, and that he would be what? He would be a blessing to all nations. So the land, the seed, and that he would be a blessing to all nations. God promised that to Abraham, and in this process of the cutting of the animal and the fire pot going in between, God is saying, I will keep my covenant. I make this covenant with you. I will be bound by this covenant to keep, you will get the land, the seed, and the blessing. And so this is a ratifying of the covenant where God participates in that. Now, there's one more cut, and this is the cut of the flesh in Genesis chapter 6:17. I need to tell you a little story why I'm bringing this up. But anyways, once upon a time, I taught at another school for 22 years, a place called Grace College. It was a very conservative school, very God-centered, Bible-centered school. And I had down front, there was this girl who sat there. You know, you ever see the students, and they take every word down what you say, and they kind of like, oh, I just believe everything. Professor Hildebrandt, you know, and stuff when I was younger, I could get away with it. And so she was really into it. And she, you know, to write everything down. She was really into the class and stuff. And so we were going over this stuff about Genesis chapter 17, and this girl raises her hand, and she says, Professor Hildebrandt, it says in this chapter that Abraham was circumcised and circumcises his son. What is that anyway? Now, my first thing was, okay, question, do students set professors up and want to argue and stuff? And I, to be honest, I enjoy that. Question, I look her straight in the face, and I'm expecting this little smirk on her face, you know, like, hey, I got you now, man. What are you going to do? And so I look at her, and she gives me this blank look, like she's so innocent, just like ready to write down the answer. I'm saying, holy cow. So she's really asking me like Bamet. I mean, in truth, she's asking me. I'm thinking, oh, I could just see it now, man. Hildebrandt gets fired for drawing pictures on the board. I'll do that. Okay. And so I said, oh. So I go home that night. I tell my wife, I said, you can't believe it. This girl, Blikobu Shah, as the Hebrews say, in front of the whole class, man, this girl asked me what circumcision is. I go, can you believe that? My wife turns to me, and she says, you know, when I was in about 7th or 8th grade, she said, I didn't know what it was either. She said, I went and asked the pastor what it was. I thought, holy cow, this is pretty weird. And then I realized, are most males now circumcised at birth almost? And what I'm saying is, a lot of guys even, you know what I'm saying, is circumcision is not even a thing. So anyways, let me just go through that to say that basically what it is at the end of the male penis, there's a skin that hangs out about a half inch. And so what happens is the doctor cuts it off and basically cuts that foreskin off. Now, by the way, that happens when you're a baby. Now, by the way, I know this, I had two boys, and so when they do it to a baby, I'm in there, I'm going, oh, you know, and when the doctor does it to a baby, do they even whimper? I'm not kidding you. I had more of a problem with it than my sons did. It was like it was over and the babies barely whimper. I don't know, man. Try that on an 18-year-old. Is that a problem? By the way, in the Bible, is that going to be a problem later on? By the way, was Abraham circumcised, or does Abraham get circumcised now at 75? Is that a problem? That's a problem. Okay. So anyway, so just some things to need to think of. By the way, is this circumcision, is this a big deal? Is circumcision how the Jews identify themselves? Are the Jews of the circumcision? And if you're a Gentile, you're what? Uncircumcised? Have you ever heard that terminology? Uncircumcised Gentiles. So that's how the Jews used it as an ethnic marker of how you're in Judaism. Now, by the way, did other cultures circumcise besides the Jews? Yes, other cultures did. But is God saying here, while other cultures also circumcise, circumcision for you means a sign of the covenant? That this is how the seal, it is sealed, the covenant is sealed in your flesh. Now let me just go over here for a second and just do, are any of you from Presbyterian background? If Presbyterians baptize children, and let me, let me bounce and just get some of this stuff up here. So on circumcision, and this becomes an unconditional covenant, okay, the land, seed, and the blessing. Are some of you from Presbyterian background, and by the way, in the Presbyterian background, do they baptize babies? Yes, they do. Do you realize it's on the basis of circumcision? They were supposed to be circumcised on the 8th day. Now, did that circumcision show that they were part of the covenant community? The circumcision of the young child showed that they were part of the covenant community. The Presbyterians, when they baptize babies, are they saying that our babies, like circumcision, and in baptism, our babies are part of the covenant community of believers in Christ? And is that why they baptize babies, infants? To basically welcome those infants into the covenant community. Now, by the way, are some of you Baptists? You don't baptize babies, okay? But can you see why the Presbyterians would do that, okay? That like circumcision in the Old Testament, baptism in the New, you're including those infants into the covenant community, okay? So that's kind of where that comes from and some of that stuff. Abraham's covenant, land, seed, and the blessing. Yes, sir. Yeah. Once Abraham has circumcised himself and his child, the condition is unconditional. That is, Abraham has fulfilled the conditions of the covenant, which means then that God is obligated for the land, the seed, and the blessing. That is an unconditional covenant now. The Abrahamic covenant is unconditional. Now, when you get into Moses' covenant, did they have to obey and to get blessings and cursings? Did they have to obey it? And then if they disobeyed, they get the curses. With Abraham, it's over. The covenant is unconditional. So God will work with Abraham's descendants. They will get the land, the seed, and the blessing. Now, there's going to be other covenants that are conditional, that are conditioned on their obedience, of like the Mosaic covenant and things. So there'll be other things. So I just wanted, this is, once he's circumcised, that's it. The covenant is fulfilled in that sense. Now, some problems, okay? Some problems. These are general problems that critics actually work with text, okay? In Genesis chapter 12, it says that Abraham has camels. Now, what's the problem with that? Years ago, they said the Bible's got an error here. Because years ago, they said camels were not domesticated until about 1200 BC. Abraham is what? What's Abraham's date? 2000. So they say Abraham is 800 years before camels were domesticated. Therefore, the Bible's got an error here. Abraham could not have had camels like that were domesticated, and therefore the Bible's got an error. Lo and behold, guess what happens? They find in Eblah, 2400 BC, that's 400 years before Abraham. Guess what the guys in Eblah have? Domesticated camels. Okay, question. Story over? Story over. Okay, so critics criticize the Bible on the basis of that, and frankly, they found out now that even 400 years before Abraham, camels were domesticated. Although, have you ever been around camels? The other question you have is, are camels ever domesticated? These animals have personality, and they are really, some of the camels are really, really ornery. I'll tell you, someday when we have some time and stuff, although this is on tape now, I'll tell you some camel stories. We stayed in the Bedouin tent for several nights, and in the Bedouin tent, the Bedouins use camels, and the guy went off one night and told us 3 hours of camel jokes. This is, yeah, it's true. Their whole culture is built around this camel. Camels are amazing animals. Okay. Camels are phenomenal animals. So, Hittites. The critics said the Hittites, the Bible says that Abraham ran into some Hittites in Genesis 15:20. But they said, hey, there's no record of any history. We know a lot about the ancient world, but there's no mention of Hittites. And so because the Bible mentions Hittites and Philistines back with Abraham, this can't be right. So the Bible's got to have errors in it and stuff. Well, once again, guess what happens? Some guy's up digging around in the middle of upper Turkey there, and all of a sudden this guy comes on, Bogothoi. It's like the capital of the Hittite Empire. This guy happens. Not only is there a Hittite, but we now know it was a whole honking empire. There's a whole language you can go and, again, get a PhD learning to read these Hittite texts, which some of them, I assume, have not been translated yet. But there's a whole culture of Hittites now. We know about now was from up in northern central Turkey, and we know then there were Hittites. By the way, does anybody remember Uriah the Hittite was Bathsheba's husband with David and stuff, and so he is another Hittite, but Abraham ran into Hittites too, and we know now that there was a whole Hittite empire up in Turkey. And so that again, critics again, wrong. Now this third one is a real problem. And if you got your Bibles, let me just read it to you. In Genesis chapter 14, verse 14, this is a serious problem. And I need to try to explain this one. It says, when Abraham heard his relative Lot had been taken captive, he called out the 318 trained men born in his household and went in pursuit as far as Dan. Now, where is Dan? The city of Dan, if I'm Jerusalem here, then Kyle, way in the back of the room, is Dan. Dan is the farthest northernest part of Israel, the city of Dan. Now you say, well, Hildebrand, what's the problem with that? He chased him up from the south where he was in Jerusalem. He chased him all the way up to the back room there. There's no problem with that. The problem is that Dan was not named Dan until the time of Joshua and Judges. Did the tribe, basically the tribe of Dan, if this is Israel here, the tribe of Dan settled out with the Philistines. Dan didn't like being around the Philistines because what happened when they were around the Philistines? The Philistines did what to people? They killed them. And Dan says, we don't like these Philistines. They beat up on us. So we're going to take our tribe from where the Philistines are on the coastal plain here. We're going to take the whole tribe. We don't want to fight with Philistines all the time. And we're going to move our whole tribe back up to where Kyle is. And we're going to take the whole tribe and shrink it down to one city. And that city was called Dan. And it's a famous city in Israel and things. But it was named only later Dan. And so what you have here is what's called an anachronism. Now, what does chronism mean? Do you see the word chronism there? A chronology, chronos means time. Anachronism means out of time. In other words, the city of Dan, Abraham didn't know the city of Dan. That's what I'm trying to say. Abraham did not know the city of Dan. Dan would not be named that for another 800 years. Now you say, well then how come it's in the Bible in Genesis? I think it's the same thing if I said to you, we're going to go to Liberty Tree Mall in, where is Liberty Tree Mall? What town? Does anybody know Danvers? I said, we're going to go to Liberty Tree Mall in Danvers. Everybody would know where that is. But if I said to you, we're going to go to Liberty Tree Mall in Salem Village, would you know where that is? Danvers, many, many years ago, used to be called Salem Village. Nobody remembers that now. So the problem is, if I'm writing a modern book and I put Salem Village, will anybody know where that is? No. But if I said Danvers, would everybody know? So what happened is the text seems to have been updated here. The text seems to have been updated, and so the original name, which is possibly Laish, is updated to Dan. Now, is it possible that Joshua, by the way, who finished the Pentateuch? Did Moses finish writing the book of Deuteronomy? No, Moses is what in Deuteronomy? He's dead at the end of the book. It's pretty hard, at least I've been told, it's pretty hard to write when you're dead. So, Moses, the book of Deuteronomy is probably finished by Joshua. Is it possible that Joshua could have inserted this name later, or somebody even later than Joshua inserted the name because he says, hey, you guys don't know where this town is. If I say Dan, everybody knows where Dan is. And so the text was updated. This is a serious issue for some people and things, but I think, to be realistic, we've got to say the name Dan, Abraham didn't know the name Dan because that was, you know, it was much later that Dan was up there. Yeah. No, that's an excellent point. She says, does that make it wrong? What I'm saying is, no, it's not wrong. It's just that the language was updated. The language was updated because nobody knows where Salem Village is. Everybody knows where Danvers is. So, yes, do you have a question? Or okay, all right. Okay, so this is a big one here. And okay, now, three kids. Abraham's got three kids. We'll just do these quickly. Eliezer of Damascus. What's Abram's problem? Sarah is barren and can't have any kids. So let me just kind of narrate the story. So Abram comes to God and says, God, you say you're going to bless me with this land, seed, and blessing. I haven't got any kids, God. This is doing me no good. And he says, moreover, he says, I don't have any kids, and Eliezer of Damascus, my servant, is going to get all the inheritance is going to go to Eliezer of Damascus. So this is the first one of Abraham's kids. Eliezer of Damascus, his servant, is going to receive the inheritance. And by the way, was that legitimate? And the answer is yes. We know that from Hammurabi's code and some of these other ancient law codes, that if a person died and had no children, who got their goods? The servant got the goods. So this was following the laws, the ancient laws, that Eliezer of Damascus would get his stuff. And God comes to him and says, no, it won't be Eliezer. It'll be somebody from your own flesh. So it won't be Eliezer. But this is the first one that Abram thought that he would have his servant. So then what happens with Hagar? And this is actually a really important text in Genesis chapter 16. Hagar, let me just narrate the story. Hagar is Abraham's handmaiden, his servant. Who sets Abraham up? Sarah. Does Sarah say to Abraham, I can't have kids, go into Hagar and conceive with her, and that child then will be basically my child, and therefore we'll give the inheritance to that. It'll be our child. Now, that is exactly like the laws of Hammurabi. They're following the laws, the customs of their day. Now, this is a big issue. We have to get out of our culture. Okay? Did the Code of Hammurabi say that it was all right for a master to go into his maid and that whatever child was had then would be his adopted child, basically? Yes, it was allowed in the laws of Hammurabi. Now, you say, wow, what is this? Man, Abraham's cheating on Sarah. Question, is Abraham cheating on Sarah? Did Sarah see it that way? Did Abraham see it that way? No. I think what you got to do is take this out of, as one fellow in the last class said, he says, Abraham's having sex with this other woman. Question, is that the American way of thinking about it? That's you guys' way of thinking about it. Did Abraham think about it like that? Abraham's having sex and cheating on his wife. No. They're thinking about it like this. Question, my wife and I can't have kids. That's not true, we have four. But if we couldn't have kids, is it possible they could take part of me, part of my wife, put it together in a test tube, and find a woman who we pay $10,000 to $20,000, and they put it in this other woman, and she, the surrogate mother, has a child? That's what's going on here. Can Abraham go to his doctor and, you know, put the parts in the test tube and put it in another woman? Abraham can't do it. Does he have to do it the natural way? And so what you've got is you've got to put it in the context of a surrogate wife. This is not cheating on his wife. His wife set this up. She's a surrogate wife. Now, by the way, even in modern times, when a test tube baby is put in another woman and she bears that child, do you remember that case in New Jersey? The woman bears the child. Does the woman who bare the child wants to keep the child? Do you remember that? The woman who bore the child was attached to the child, and she didn't want to give it back to the husband and wife. Okay. So question, does this cause problems even in modern American terms with test tubes and babies? It still causes problems. Question, was there a problem then after Sarah gave Hagar into her husband's lap and stuff? Question, is there jealousy between Hagar and Sarah? Yes. Did it work back then, or were there problems associated with this? Now, question, does this mean that God approves of this? Or was this what they did in that culture? Are there stuff recorded in the Bible that's not necessarily saying this is true for all time, that was part of that culture that is not meant to be universalized? Okay, so you've got to separate cultural norms from moral universals. You've got to separate those two. And by the way, does God cover for Ishmael and Hagar? Does God protect them? Yeah, God takes care of them even after Sarah kicks her out and things, and they go in the desert and stuff. So this is a pretty big thing here. And then finally, you get this. Isaac is a son of promise, born to Sarah and Abraham when they're in their very old now. We're talking 100 years and that kind of stuff. And Isaac's name means what? Yitzhak. Yitzhak means laughter. Sarah laughed. Did Abraham also laugh? He also laughed. And so his name is Yitzhak, laughter, Isaac. And this is the son of the promise then, the one that's son of the promise and stuff. We'll call it quits there, and we'll see you on Thursday.
This is Dr. Ted Hildebrandt in the 8th lecture of his Old Testament History, Literature, and Theology class. This lecture will begin with the sons of God and the daughters of men in Genesis chapter 6, and proceed to Abraham, God's friend, the geography of Mesopotamia, as well as three cuts in Abraham's life, as well as his three alleged children.